Is there a teacher in your life who continues to inspire you? Tonight, we bring you the life and times of an extraordinary American teacher, mentor, and cultural ambassador. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. James McGrath, in a class by himself, is Jonah Raskin's portrait of this remarkable teacher. And Jonah joins Rosemary Manchester in conversation about him. Later in the broadcast, Rosemary talks with Allison Owings on her book, Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans. And Barbara Quick is back with her audio essay on Elena Ferrante's new novel, My Brilliant Friend. It's all ahead. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. In an overheard conversation at a friend's party, prolific author Jonah Raskin became intrigued with the subject of the conversation, a teacher that several guests had in common. This led Raskin on a journey that took him to the Southwest and that in fact influenced the way Raskin himself approached the art of teaching. Here's Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Jonah Raskin on James McGrath, in a class by himself.
This book is not a novel. It's not a biography, or is it? It's not a memoir. What is it?
Well, it could be called a group portrait because there is a main person who you would say is at the center,
yes,
of the picture, and that's mm-hmm. James McGrath, and
right.
then. Who was a teacher, who's still a teacher. He's 85, I believe, now, and he's still teaching. And then there are his fellow teachers, and then there are his students. So it's a group portrait.
Even his disciples, you might say, because they are so closely affiliated with him. He's had such an influence on their lives.
Yes, he still is in touch with students who were in his first class in the early 50s. And, gosh, I think it's like more than 60 years ago.
Amazing.
And they were teenagers, and now they're in their 70s and their 80s. Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did you first encounter James McGrath? Was he your teacher at any point?
No, he wasn't. Okay. He was the teacher of three men who live around here. One of them is Bob Hudson, who lives in Cotati, and the other ones are Bill Allen and Bill Wiley, and they live in Marin. And there was a party at Bob Hudson's house in Cotati, and the three of them were there, and they were sitting around drinking beer, and they were talking about their high school art teacher. So my ears, like, perked up. I mean, to me, that's very rare for me to hear grown-up people talking about a high school teacher. So I got interested. How come after all these years they were still talking about him and acknowledging his influence on him and also saying that they influenced him? So it wasn't just one way. It was reciprocal and back and forth. And he's always also, when he's talked about the students in his first class at Columbia High School in Richland, Washington, he's always said that they were like a cohort and they supported one another and they influenced one another and they sort of bounced off one another. So, I mean, the title is in a class by himself. He is unique, but he's also, in another way, the title is misleading because he's never been alone. He's always been around with other people and done group projects.
Yes. And of course, in the class infers that there are students in the class. So he wasn't alone in that sense either. Yeah.
Yes.
It sounds like serendipity that you went to the party and heard that conversation. And then how did you follow up?
So I learned that he was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, mm-hmm. and I got his phone number and I called him up and I kept calling him and talking to him and taking notes. And then I decided, well, I said to him one day, I think I better come and visit you. And so, I flew from Oakland down to Albuquerque, and he told me, well, there's an airport you can take from Albuquerque to Santa Fe, and I'll meet you at this street corner. And he did, and we drove out to his place. He lives on the outskirts of Santa Fe. He lives in a place where human beings have lived since the 16th century.
Right.
Or before, actually. I mean, Europeans have been there since the 16th century. But on the mesa above his house, there's petroglyphs. There are thousands of petroglyphs on the rocks that are just extraordinary. Thousands of them. They just go for more than a mile. And I've hiked up there. I've hiked up by myself. I've hiked up there with him. He's quite a bit older than I am, but he gets up the hill and down the hill faster than I do.
Oh, I've been on hikes with those people.
Yes. Yes.
They're like jackrabbits.
I still didn't know that I was going to write about him, I don't think, until I went to his place.
Ah.
And I saw his house, which he had a large part in building. It was an old stagecoach destination. And he restored it. He put in a floor, he put in a ceiling, and just about everything. And he has saved documents and papers and from all these different phases of his life. And he's got all kinds of files there, and he keeps all sorts of records. And he's also, so he's lived in Africa, he's lived in Asia, he's lived in various, in Europe, he's taught in all these places. And he has things from all over the world. He's got paintings, he's got ceramics, he's got this huge decorated buffalo skin that's on the wall. It's bigger than any of the walls in here in the studio. And it's like being in a museum. He's been sending off everything to the Smithsonian. I mean, he's been sending thousands of things to the Smithsonian. So I mean, he's also a rare collector of art and artifacts.
Yes.
And he's I was there in November, and I stayed at his place again, and I didn't really see any sign that there are any fewer things there. things are just crammed in.
Uh-huh.
So then I visited him there. I talked to him. I stayed there for 5 days. I got a huge amount of information. And then he said, well, there's a lot of my files and my records that I sent to the library at the University of Washington in Seattle, where he had been a student there years and years earlier. So I arranged to go to Seattle to stay right near campus and to go to the archives in the basement of the library there, and they just brought out these boxes and boxes. And he saved his college papers, all of his college papers. They were there. He saved student work from his first teaching, talks that he gave, diaries. And so it wasn't just based on his memory, but on the sort of on documentary records that were there. So I think that added to my sense of who he was and where he lived, how he was educated, who his own teachers were, and how he became a teacher. And, I mean, for example, one of the things that he said when I met him was that he'd been a stutterer.
Yes, that was so interesting. Yes.
From the age of about five.
Yes.
And he'd done speech therapy from the time he was a boy, and he actually stuttered until he got his first teaching job. when he stood in front of the class and he just said, I've got to just will myself not to stutter, because if I stutter in front of these students, I will just lose them. And he was discouraged by his own teachers from becoming a teacher. They would say, you don't want to become a teacher. You'll just be an embarrassment to yourself and everybody else. But he was so determined to become a teacher that he didn't listen to them. You know? And he's always said that his own experience with his own stuttering gave him this sort of insight into people who had other kinds of, I don't know what to call them, disabilities or handicaps is the old word, or aspects about themselves that made it difficult for them to communicate or disclose. And so he's been really good at being also to be able to bring people out from wherever they are and to use art to be able to express themselves and to heal themselves. Yeah.
He was doing art therapy before it was invented.
Yes, amazing. Definitely. So then the other thing I would say about him is that I think when I was starting to do this sort of work, there was all that emphasis on testing students. That was part of the George Bush administration of No Child Left Behind,
yes.
Which everybody sort of bought it. All kinds of people bought into it. So McGrath has never been about testing people.
Right.
I mean, he did sometimes give multiple choice quizzes. He saved those and have people write essays. But basically, he was about people making art and evaluating them and grading them and judging them on the basis of whatever kind of art they made. It's either finger painting or watercolors or oil painting or sculpting or weaving or silk screening or collage or batik, paper mache, puppets. You know, there isn't an art form that he has not taught and doesn't know how to do, and he would learn it himself as he was teaching it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very quick learner. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As I read the book, particularly as I reread the book, it occurred to me that the importance of place. This is a book about a man of the West. This
yes.
is not Goodbye, Mr. Chips. This is not Preppies in the East. This is almost a pioneering story in a place where pioneering is still possible. And then it's also a little unlikely. Richland, Washington, you wouldn't necessarily predict that that's where a great teacher would be formed. But that's the way it happened. He had the freedom there to create his own style of teaching.
Yes, Rosemary, I think that's very insightful. It is a story about the West.
Yes.
It's a story about Washington and Oregon and New Mexico and
yes.
Arizona, the Pacific Northwest and the Southwest.
And the desert, yeah.
Yes.
Not that he was not a world citizen and a cosmopolitan person who worked and taught and studied all over the world, and yet his roots are so deep in the freedom that he had in the West to create his own style.
So he also was and still is an artist himself, a painter.
Mm-hmm.
But he said there was a certain point when he was in his 20s where he said he wanted to make teaching his art form. Now, I don't think I had ever really heard. I've been around teachers most of my life. I taught at Sonoma State for 30 years. I never really heard anybody say teaching is my art form.
The art of teaching.
Yes. Yeah. Now... And I was teaching, I think, for about 3 or 4 years at Sonoma State after I met McGrath. And so he did also influence my own teaching, where I was more disclosing of myself in the classroom, Well, I've always prepared for class, but I've also got to be more trusting of spontaneity and improvising and allowing what's happening, what's right in the classroom to taking my cues from what's the students who are there and from what's happening in front of me. Not to always adhere, yes, to have some ideas and some goals, but things take unpredictable things happen in the classroom, and very often they're very worth like following and using.
As I look back to the courses that I took on teaching and education, I don't recall any encouragement of spontaneity. It was all by rote. It was the most boring classes I ever took in my entire education, history of education, you know, educational methods, boring, boring, boring. And they just took all the life out of you, and certainly all the enthusiasm that one might bring to teaching, to try to impress upon you that this is the way it's always been done and this is the way you will do it.
Yeah, so I'm gonna. So I wanted to tell a story about one of my last classes at Sonoma State. It was with first year students. They were 17 and 18 years old. They were away from home for the first time. They were away from their parents for the first time in their lives. And in class one day, they said they wanted to make a mural. And I said, "Great, fine." And we talked about whether to do the mural right on the wall in the classroom is or on paper, and they decided that they wanted to do it right on the wall. And I said, well, if something happens or, you know, we get scolded for doing this, I will take all responsibility for it, and you won't get into trouble. So, well, I mean, we did get into trouble. You know, we...
Of course you did.
You know, they said the students, they painted on three walls.
Yes.
And they had flowers, they had trees, they had gardens, they had quotations from Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Mother Teresa and all kinds of bright colors and they signed their names, and they did their they put their prints in paint and put those on the wall, and it was fantastic. And I got a call saying that we had defaced the walls.
Defaced. I knew that word
they
was coming.
They didn't recognize that it was art. I mean, right. I think they should have left it there.
Of course.
Because it was beautiful.
Of course.
So I learned a lot by them doing this. They learned a lot about this. And this is like 17 people who are, they're kind of working together, but they're also working on their own individually. Mm-hmm. And we also learned about Sonoma State. Mm-hmm. We had the lesson that you can't, this is not tolerated.
That's right.
It's defacing this thing. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, and I got a call saying, from some administrator saying, I'm going to report the students because they'd all signed their work. They were proud of having signed it. I'm going to report these people to the campus police. But if you will take responsibility and say you are the one who encouraged this, I won't report them. So I said, yeah, well, I take full responsibility.
Jonah, that's an amazing story.
So we did – people, the students, you know, they all have their phones, so they all yes. filmed this. So we have we did have a record of it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's really sad, but that's part of education, you know, that sometimes you get into trouble for – I mean, that's so sad about our society that we punish people for their innovation.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Now, tell me, McGrath – worked overseas, had fairly important positions, teaching in the schools for the children of the military.
Yes.
Now, how in the world did a man this innovative learn to work with a structure like the military?
Yes, he was in the 50s, he was teaching for the Army, the
yes.
sons and daughters of people in the Army. Some Americans, also the sons and daughters of people who worked for corporations in Europe, and then in and then later on in Asia, for the Department of Defense.
Yes,
he's very good at working with bureaucracies and hierarchies. He's very inclusive. He includes everybody. When he worked in Asia, he had workshops in the Philippines for students with disabilities, handicapped, blind, and he got the U.S. Air Force to fly hundreds of students from Korea, from Japan, from Formosa, all these places to this retreat in the Philippines, and getting the military for supplies. Now, I mean, this was before sequestration. But even in places where there is very small budgets, he always figured out how to do projects and how to do large projects and workshops. So, I think that he learned a lot from his first teaching job in Richland, Washington, at Columbia High School. Because most everybody who lived in Richland, Washington, or the fathers anyway, worked at the Hanford nuclear plant,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which was very close by.
Yes.
And this was at a time when they were making atomic bombs. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the fathers were physicists and they're actually making the bombs, and others were electricians and carpenters and doing sort of supplemental kind of activities. The town was owned by General Electric. No people didn't at the time that he lived there. Nobody owned their own house.
Oh.
None of the people who worked at Hanford were supposed to say what they did. So they grew up. They were called the Bombers. The athletic teams were called the Bombers,
oh,
and the mascot was a bomb. When they had a basketball game, they put a little bomb at midcourt.
Oh dear!
And they had the pictures of the mushroom cloud were sort of every place.
Well, that was the biggest game in town.
Absolutely.
Oh,
they had nuclear frontier days in the summer.
It's incredible.
With parades and everything like that. It was like kind of really a worship of the bomb.
Yeah. And how interesting that then he ended up in Santa Fe, which is so close to Los Alamos. So
yes.
It's almost as though that thing was shadowing him.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and when he was teaching at Columbia High School, one of the innovative things that he did was to take the students to visit the Indians, the Yakima Indians, and
yes.
to take them to the Columbia and the Yakima Rivers, to get them out of the classroom and away from the nuclear culture to the land, to go out in the desert. And students said, I really had no idea that there was a desert here. I had no idea that there were Indians here.
There's more to learning than sitting in the classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk with you a bit about his work in Santa Fe at Institute of American Indian Art, where he spent a number of years at the Institute, didn't he? It was a big, important part of his life.
Yes.
And he worked with some of the best-known names, Fritz Scholder and R.C.
Yes.
Gorman and Alan
yes.
Hauser, as well as people we probably never heard of and may never hear of.
Right. Well, you mentioned a lot of the key people. So, yes, McGrath was at the Institute for American Indian Arts from 1962 to 1973. And it was started when Kennedy was president, and then Kennedy was shot and killed soon after that, and it became a major thing for the Johnson administration. And McGrath, it was very interesting, and the whole evolution of the school, because it's a high school for Indians.
Oh, a high school. I didn't realize that. I thought it was on the college level. Okay.
They did have a two-year program for the equivalent of, I guess, of an AA degree that you can get at a community college. Mm-hmm. But 99% of the students who were there were high school students.
Oh.
This was in the age when people were supposed to be integrating education.
Right.
But it was an intentionally segregated school that only took Indians. There had been schools for Indians before, but this was Indians from dozens and dozens of tribes from all over the country. So you'd have Indians from the state of Washington meeting Indians from New Mexico and Arizona and Arkansas. And the time that he was there was the time when it was the rise of sort of red power and Indians becoming aware of their own ancestry and being proud to be Indians and acknowledging their heritage.
So it was fortuitous for him to be there at that time when they were more open to his style of teaching and
yes.
his style of opening up the world.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, exactly. So now McGrath is Irish, descendant of, you know, Irish immigrants and English immigrants. So, he's a white person. Mm-hmm. Though he did have an Indian uncle, and when he was a boy, he would spend summers with his uncle, whose uncle had the great name Napoleon Bonaparte Napier, who taught him how to like walk on a log without getting into the water, and how to follow skunks without getting skunked, and how to find clams to eat, and. So he did know about Indians from boyhood, and he's always been very careful about being an outsider and a white person in this other culture.
Yes.
He did, at the Institute for American Indian Arts, he did have a very close friend and lover, Otele La Loma.
I wondered if that wasn't a more personal relationship than was disclosed in the book, because it sounded like that, but yet it wasn't spelled out as such.
I didn't describe their amorous, amorous part of it. But she was a Hopi Indian, and they used to go from Santa Fe. They would drive. It's about a 6-7 hour drive from Santa Fe to the Hopi Reservation in Arizona. And they would stay in her village. So he got to see what Hopi life was like from the inside. And she told him all kinds of stories about the Hopi that she learned from her grandmother and her mother and been passed down from generation to generation. So he's very careful about what he says about the Hopi and their ways. Because there have been sort of white writers who've gone in and then were asked not to repeat things and write about them.
That's
then they did.
And then they do, right.
And that the Indians felt like, well, you know, we didn't want you to, like, expose our culture.
Yeah. I'm always distressed at the lack of reverence for the Kachina figures of the Hopi. I mean, those are very important in their religion. They're not, we call them dolls. They're not dolls. They're representation of the.
Yes.
And Anglos are so blasé about many of those things that are sacred to the Indians.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. The Department of the Interior thought that Indian art, they didn't see it as art.
They said
that these are the Indians. They're part of their savage rituals, and they're part of their superstitions.
Oh dear!
And we don't want to perpetuate them.
And they also tended to think of anything the Indians made as craft rather than art. And there's a certain distinction between art and craft that usually craft comes off as something less important than art. Just the word has a connotation of something handmade and kind of cutesy, like a crocheted potholder or something.
So, and you mentioned that, you know, Scholder and Gorman, and they were just coming into their own.
Yes.
when they were at the Institute for American Indian Arts. And he, Scholder did this one painting that had Americans who were American Indians who were wrapped in American flags.
That's right. Very famous painting.
Mm-hmm. And then and people said, "Oh, well, that's wonderful. You're so this is a wonderfully patriotic, you know, painting that you're that you've done here." And he said, "Well, I was actually just describing what the Indians did. The government gave all the Indians American flags, and they liked them as decoration, and they used them as to wrap themselves in instead of the, some of their old blankets."
The first time I saw a Fritz Scholder painting, I thought, what the heck is that? You know, I'm very unsophisticated in those days with my ideas of art. And when I saw R.C. Gorman's art, you know, I could and Hauser, I could easily relate to that because it was something I understood. So, you know, I had a long way to go as to appreciating it as well.
Yeah. So the story of McGrath and the three students of his who live around here is going to be continuing because next year there's going to be an exhibit at the Sonoma County Museum of McGrath's work and Hudson's work and Allen and Wiley's work.
We'll be sure to let our listeners know when that's going to happen.
Yes.
Jonah, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, but I'm so glad we could spend this time talking about James McGrath and his work. It was a new name to me. I'm delighted to know about him, and I look forward to next year. Perhaps he'll even come to town for the exhibit at the museum?
Oh, McGrath is going to be here. Oh,
excellent.
Definitely. Yes, we're going to have poetry readings because he writes poetry and reads poetry. And it's going to be in part about teachers and students and the reciprocal relationships that they have.
Well, we'll follow up on that with Novel Idea.
Great.
Okay. Thanks again, Jonah. It's great talking with you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Jonah Raskin talking with Rosemary Manchester on his latest book, James McGrath in a Class by Himself, published by Macabre Press. Stay with us for Allison Owings on Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans, and Barbara Quick's review of Elena Ferrante's new novel, My Brilliant Friend. We'll be right back. Allison Owings is a listener, and through her books gives her subjects a place to be heard. Her work includes Frauen, the stories of 29 German women who recall how they lived through the Third Reich, and Hey Waitress, a revealing portrait of waitresses and a slice of American life. She talks with Rosemary Manchester about her 2011 book, Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans.
It's a beautiful book, Allison. The cover is so attractive. That group of Native American women laughing and in their beautiful, colorful clothes. It made me want to be part of that group. I wanted to find out, what's the joke? Let me in on this.
Okay. This is a group, actually, it's men and women. You might have been might have been distracted by all those braids, but those are men in the braids. And the joke is that they are laughing at the photographer about whose face is going to break the camera. And I have to say that I did fight for this cover because I wanted to show that Native Americans have a lot of humor in their lives. And this is one of the many stereotypes that non-natives, that nons have about them, that they're stoic and dour and they don't laugh, but they laugh a lot. And this shows that they do.
Oh, this cover was worth fighting for.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah. Now, this isn't your first book.
No.
By any means.
No. My first book is actually a silly book that none of the serious publishers would put on the inside jacket, and it's called the Wonder Woman's phrase book, How to Meet or Avoid People in Three Romance Languages, which was published by Shameless Hussy Press of Berkeley.
I'd buy that book.
that took about a half an hour to write, as opposed to the others that all took close to a decade.
Yes.
So the first serious book was called Frauen, German Women Recall the Third Reich. And that was followed by Hey Waitress, the USA from the Other Side of the Tray, and then this.
Yes. And this form that you use in going around and interviewing or talking with individual people and not generalizing or putting your own thoughts in, but just simply presenting them through the conversation that you have with them, I find that very effective.
Well, thank you. I think that, of course, everyone is an individual, and I'm very much drawn to people who are stereotyped and not seen as individuals. And this is the case in all three of my bigger books. And I knew that Native people were stereotyped terribly. Actually, this is the first time I decided to interview men as well as women.
Yes.
Because there was really no good reason not to. And I simply interviewed them and just let them talk.
Yes.
And talk and talk and talk. And then came the other work of putting together a profile. So each person, or basically each person, has his or her own chapter in the book.
And you've pulled off for me what seems to be the incredibly difficult job of being our ears and eyes and yet being unobtrusive. We are aware through your writing that you are the one who's recording the conversation, but you don't intrude yourself.
Oh, well, thank you. That was
That
was a big challenge, actually. And I always object to interviews that I see, whether on stage or here on radio or see on television, where the interviewer seems to think, well, I'm just as important as you are, and let me tell you all about myself. And the guest is really secondary. And I wanted very much to be in the background and keep myself out of it as much as I could. And I blame my writing group, which has been around a long time and has seen me through many of these chapters. They kept saying, we need more of you. We need more of you. We want to see these people and hear them through your eyes and through your ears. So I would reluctantly put a little more of myself in, but I really wanted to stay as much in the background as I could, because this is not a book called Conversations with Native Americans. It's Listening to Native Americans.
I didn't
want to share the stage, really. I wanted it to be their story and not mine.
Yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, you did a superb job of just that.
And you have to respect the reader to make his or her own judgments. This was very much the fact in my first book, my first big book, Frauen, German Women Recall the Third Reich, where I would have the reader decide, do I believe this woman or not? Is she telling the truth or not? I didn't want to say, I think she's lying or I think she's not lying. So I really feel that people should be taken at their word, whether or not, in fact, that word is accurate or not, and let the reader decide. Now, sometimes I have to intrude a little bit if something is historically off or is a little suspect. I mean, there are different ways, sort of subtle ways of intruding, of whether to say this is not borne out by newspaper accounts of the same story, that sort of thing. But in general, I like the reader to decide what to think of this person they're reading about.
And you've chosen three groups of people that are as you say, stereotyped. You felt very strongly was unfair or...
This is true. Although the first book, Frauen, German Women Recall the Third Reich, I started that thinking that I had my own stereotype about them. I wanted to believe in sort of a feminist way that German women were, so to speak, better than German men, and they'd all been great rescuers and they all hated Hitler. And the very first woman I interviewed started talking about the idealism of National Socialism. And I thought, whoop, I've got to change that. So in a way, I was de-stereotyping my own stereotype in talking about them and to them. So I tried to find as many German women from as many different backgrounds and as many different opinions as I could find.
Yes.
So it was an inadvertent foray into anti-stereotyping. The others were more deliberate. Yes. The waitresses I knew were stereotyped. Mm-hmm. Native people I knew were stereotyped. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have my own agenda that I had to change.
Right. You were not there as a missionary or an anthropologist.
Right.
You were there as a listener.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Wonderful. And you crossed the country from east to west.
When I started Indian Voices, I interviewed a few people who lived near me in California. Then I decided to take some further trips. And once I was launched, I went all over the place, somewhat directionlessly. I would find somebody who had agreed to talk with me. Then maybe I would do some editing of somebody else's books. That's my other rent payer, is to work as an editor and a freelance writer. And then I'd get some money together, and then I'd go and interview somebody here or there. It was not according to any kind of geographic plan. It had to do more with when it seemed like a good time to visit a certain place, whether there was a ceremony going on or whether it was accessible by road in the winter and that kind of thing.
How many years did it take to complete this work in this book?
Almost a decade.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had no idea it would take so long. I never have any idea that things are going to take as long as they do. But I found notes recently that I had taken in the fall of 2002, my initial ideas about writing the book. And my writing group remembers that I was talking about this and I think tried to dissuade me. They were smart.
Well, they might have been smart, but I'm glad they failed. Several things just spring off the page as you bring them up, and it seemed to me that they were common to most of the people that you talk to. And one of the most dreadful things is the sending the children away to school. And you have a wonderful story of when you first heard they went to boarding school, you thought, oh, I had no idea they went places like Phillips Andover. And then as the truth of the boarding school system came through from their stories. It's a terrible thing, isn't it?
It is terrible. And it's terrible to me that so few non-natives know about it. And this is something known to virtually every Native American, that there was a federally recognized and approved plan to rip Indian children from their homes from roughly the 1860s to about the 1930s and send them to boarding schools, government run boarding schools. Sometimes the schools were run by religious orders, but in general they were government schools, and to quote unquote civilize them. Oh. And this meant cut their hair, take off the clothes that they had come with, give them uniforms, forbid them to speak their language, forbid them to do anything that seemed native, and to be good Christians, more or less. Mm-hmm. And these children were sometimes thousands of miles away from home, and sometimes for years. And there were other kinds of schools. Some were day schools, and some had less odious problems. But in general, I think it was an awful thing to do.
Yes.
And a lot of people say that it caused great harm among Native people, because then these children would come back home and they no longer could speak the language that their parents spoke, and their parents didn't speak English, and things started breaking down. Mm-hmm. And the irony is to me that because of casinos now, those casinos that make any money, one of their big projects is language immersion programs. So mm-hmm. they are funding programs mm-hmm. by which Native people are trying to relearn the languages that were really ripped from their throats.
Mm-hmm. Ironies abound.
Yes,
here,
they do. They do, yes.
But you wonder why anyone would ever have thought it was a good idea to set up that system.
Actually, there are so many bad policies in U.S. history about Native people. In almost every one, I think you can find some kernel of a rationale that they would convince you makes it seem like it's really a good idea, that we are doing this for them. And they'll do much better if they're more like us, and that is more like European Americans. And in general, it just was not the case. I think it can be shown that a lot of people thought yes, this is a good thing. The same way with missionary schools. And they thought, we're doing this for your own good. There's a famous expression, kill the Indian and save the man. That was made by a man who ran one of these boarding schools. So in general, I think they thought this was a good idea. I don't know why. They hadn't thought it through, really, obviously. And I think generally it wasn't a good idea. Some people said, oh, it was fine. We got a good education. I mean, there are individual stories of people who say they thrived, they prospered. But it just pointed out the clash between Native culture and non-Native culture,
yes,
which was huge.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Kansas, and I was aware of the Haskell Indian Institute there. But I always thought, what a fine thing, because, of course, I didn't know anything about it. And perhaps by the time I was aware of it, I hope that it had changed a bit for the best.
An awful lot of people went to Haskell. It's one of the most famous of,
yes,
the boarding schools.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, it's said to be a great place of renewal. And so it is basically a tribal college. And people go there and try to restore what they lost.
Oh, that's encouraging.
And yet there are, according to someone I know who went there, there still are senses of the ghosts of the past.
Of course.
But it's now something entirely different.
That's interesting.
But it was one of the worst places,
yeah,
one of the first two.
Mm-hmm. Another problem that you addressed that cropped up in a number of the interviews, repatriation. Mm-hmm. Of the artifacts, which are so precious to the tribe and are stolen from them and turn up in museums, which want to hang on to them.
Yes, I know. And that's another word that is well known to virtually all Native American adults, repatriation. And most non-Native adults have no idea what it means, or they think it has something to do with immigration, maybe.
Yes.
And it essentially means giving back to the tribes articles that were not necessarily even stolen, but bought from people. And not only artifacts, but bones. And the bones, I would say, are the most emotionally laden objects that museums have. It's also, of course, difficult to tell whose bones a museum has. So it gets very, very, very complicated. One of my stories involves an Ojibwe woman who is in charge of repatriation for her tribe. And she explains the whole process. It's a federal law now. You have to, as a museum, if you get federal money, you have to explain that these are the items that we have, and you have to let the tribes know about them, and they go over them to see if there is something that is theirs, and they can ask for it back. It's a long, long process. I mean, it can take years. You have to be very certain of your facts. And, of course, most of these objects were not signed, but there are other indications of whose they were just because of the design or the place where they were located. It's a fractious argument, and it's a fractious area. And the woman I interviewed, this Ojibwe woman, said, museums say, oh, we'll lose all our displays and we'll have nothing left in our display cases. And she says, that's just ridiculous. They have so many things that they don't know where they came from anyway, so they wouldn't be repatriated. And she said, we have nothing against lending them back to you if you want to put them on display.
Mm-hmm. But imagine if you identified something as your grandmother's beadwork and the museum people said, prove it. I mean, it's such a slap.
And she, in fact, talked about going to the Heard Museum in Arizona, and with a tribal elder who said, oh, that's the cradle board that my grandmother made or that my mother made. And the Heard won't give it back because it wasn't communally owned. It was privately owned by this one family. Mm-hmm. That's in the aspect of the law that's kind of complicated.
It seemed to me that it's a characteristic of the nons who make the laws to move the goalposts a lot. And change the rules, and oops, they slipped through on that one, so let's close that door. And it's just, as you read these stories, you think, how can the Native people possibly have a sense of humor and have a cheerfulness to, I know there's a great deal of depression and you certainly bring this out, but many of the people you talk to have this wonderful acceptance of adversity. Well, they've certainly had lots of practice. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think they are not, of course, the only people who find gallows humor as a way to get through the day or to get through life. So I think that's maybe a universal human trait. But when I began this, I had no idea that they were just so funny. And almost everybody was very, very funny. For instance, I'm a vegetarian, and virtually everybody said, well, in my native language, and it didn't matter what native language it was because it was just a joke anyway, they said, you know, how vegetarian translates, it means bad hunter. So there were just silly things like that. And they referred to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BIA, as saying that it really refers to bossing Indians around. And then they tease each other mercilessly.
Yeah.
And they laugh and tease. I mean, actually, I think of humor as pretty much an American trait. I'm sure that other countries think that they're also very funny. But I think that is an American trait, is humor. And Native people are Americans. I mean, they're Native Americans, but they're also American Americans.
Yes.
And they laugh like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Corny jokes, lousy jokes, gallows humor, you name it. They're laughing about it. It was a great treat.
Yeah.
Throughout all these years I've had working on the book and talking to Native people and certainly reading an awful lot to help stem my own ignorance. What surprises me is that Native people in many instances tried so hard to accommodate these strangers among them. And I don't know that in general non-Native people reciprocated. They reciprocated in terms of iconography. Oh, what beautiful blankets, what beautiful music, whatever. Let's use your word for a helicopter and cities and cars. But I don't think, in general, non-Native America really appreciated Native America. And I don't think they appreciate Native Americans today, but they're here.
Yeah. Well, I think that the work you've done for the last 10 years in putting this beautiful book together is going to place your readers on a different path. And I certainly encourage people to get your hands on this book.
Thank you, Rosemary.
Allison, it's so good of you to come in. And would you mention your website, please? Because you have a spectacular website.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's very cleverly named AllisonOwings.com. That's it. Allison with one L, AllisonOwings.com. That's my website.
Yes. And the book is Indian Voices Listening to Native Americans. It's by Allison Owings, published by Rutgers University in 2011. It's in the library. It's in the bookstores. It's online. Go get a copy of this book because you will be so glad that you read it.
Barbara Quick is an author and screenwriter whose work includes Vivaldi's Virgins and A Golden Web. And today she brings us Elena Ferrante's My Brilliant Friend.
The newest novel by Italian writer Elena Ferrante delivers everything we want from a great work of literature. Hypnotically fascinating, My Brilliant Friend is a book about the fierce and lasting nature of the friendships we forge in childhood and the ways in which we use these friendships to figure out who we are. Following a short but intriguing prologue set in the present day, Ferrante's story begins in an impoverished borough on the periphery of Naples in the brutal and mysterious world of 1950s post-war Italy. The narrator is Lenu, short for Elena, who is one of the two brightest girls in the poor and benighted neighborhood plagued by violence, where she and the shoemaker's daughter, Lila, are growing up as best friends and secret rivals. Lanu and Lila are first bound together as two intellectually and creatively gifted little girls stuck in a community where female intelligence is seen by nearly everyone as a social liability. Whereas Lanu thrives on her teacher's praise and loves approval, Lila is someone who seems to live to break society's rules and defy its expectations. She is fiercer even than the neighborhood boys, who are themselves like something straight out of The Godfather. Describing their world, Lanu says matter-of-factly, "Life was like that, that's all. La vita era così e basta." We grew up with the duty to make it difficult for others before they made it difficult for us. Sorry, I couldn't resist giving you a taste of the original Italian. Ferrante does a brilliant job evoking the horrors and mysteries of this world, its violence and brutality, the greed, passions, and occasional kindness of its inhabitants, all told from a child's dispassionate point of view. Lanu wins her parents' reluctant support as her teacher pushes her to continue her studies beyond grade school. Lila isn't so lucky, but nonetheless she manages to study on her own everything that Lanu is studying in school, in every case surpassing her. Their lives are different and distinct, and yet inextricably interwoven. When one is up, the other is down. It was, Lanu says, as if because of an evil spell, the joy or sorrow of one required the sorrow or joy of the other. The language and the story of my brilliant friend, originally published in 2012 as L'Amica Geniale, work in perfect synchrony to open a doorway for the reader into a fully realized and fascinating community, richly peopled and with its own very particular set of rules. Ferrante writes with piercing wisdom about the ambiguities of all human relationships, but especially about the subtle mixture of love and competition we feel for our friends. My Brilliant Friend is the first third of a longer novel being brought out, volume by volume, as a trilogy. It was hard for me, both times I read this book, to put it down. But when I did, I re-emerged into my own world as if equipped with a magical pair of glasses that allowed me to see my own life, my own friendships, and human nature itself with greater acuity. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Thanks to all who made the show possible today, and I hope you're inspired to pick up one of the books we spoke of, Jonah Raskin's James McGrath in a Class by Himself, published by Macaw Press, Allison Owings' Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans, by Rutgers University Press, and Elena Ferrante's My Brilliant Friend, translated by Anne Goldstein and published by Europa Books. You can visit Barbara Quick at barbaraquick.com. And you can visit us next month right here. Or you can listen online at krcb.org or subscribe to our podcast and listen through iTunes. I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.